Welcome once again to Cinemaholics. I am John Negroni, the box office columnist for Adam Tickets, head writer of Cinemaholics.com, and I write books sometimes. He is a pop culture writer for Cinema Blend, and he also reviews films for Cinemaholics. It is Will Ashton.
Hi.
You can find more episodes of Cinemaholics, including our full archive, on Cinemaholics.com. You can write into the show anytime by emailing us, cinemaholicspodcast@gmail.com. And as always, two ways to support us. You can support us by sending us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts, not to be confused with Uber 5-star ratings, which seem very perilous to attain, Will Ashton. I don't want to have to go through all of that, but yeah, just we don't have any Canadian chocolates for you folks, but yeah, anything you can send our way would be awesome. And as always, you can become one of our monthly patrons on patreon.com/cinemaholics. Check out the link in the show notes to see more details on that. Will, we've had quite a week. We had a whole bonus episode about Midsommar, however you pronounce it. It came out a little bit ago. We weren't sure if this episode was going to come out on time. Glad we could make it happen, but
yeah, barely.
Yeah, but our Midsommar conversation. Were you a fan? Did you like how that one turned out?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't had a chance to listen back to it, but I mean, I remember while we were recording it, I had fun talking with Julia Tatey and yourself and discussing pretty much a wide array of different things about that movie or what that movie could inspire. So I definitely thought it was a fun conversation. I hope people enjoy it.
Yeah, it's a good hour and 20 of just us talking about a single movie. I always love when we get a chance to do that. In this episode, we're going to be talking about a bunch of different things. We're going to be talking about Crawl, which is a new horror, hurricane, monster, not really monster movie, but yeah, it's got like alligators.
Yeah, monster predator, kind of like that idea.
Yeah, exactly. And then we're also going to be getting into an R-rated buddy comedy starring Camille Nanjiani and Dave Bautista, which is called Stuber. And then we will be finishing out the show with a review of the new indie, dry, black, dark comedy, The Art of Self-Defense. That's going to be interesting. But before we get into any of all of that, The Farewell, that just hit limited release. I talked about this film a little bit ago. This is Lulu Wang's new film. This is her second film. I didn't see her first. And do you plan on checking this one out anytime soon, Will?
Oh, for sure, yeah. I was definitely very excited after the, I think, buzz from Sundance, right? That's where it premiered. Or am I thinking of a different festival? Yeah. Yeah, I was definitely... It definitely was on my radar after that, and then I was given the false hope that it was coming out in my area this weekend, and then I looked at the show times and I realized that I'll have to wait at least another week before it comes to my city. But yeah, so I'm glad you got the chance to see it. I believe you saw it at Sundance though, right? Or did you see it somewhere else? You saw it at San Francisco Film Festival.
I did see it in San Francisco. It wasn't the film festival, but oh, you know what? I think it was the film festival, because I think I'm confusing it with another... I thought for a second maybe there was a special event A24 did, but no, it was San Francisco. I missed it at Sundance, unfortunately, but this is the film with Awkwafina, who just... One of my favorite films of the year. A lot of the reasons for that come from Awkwafina's performance, and I'm very excited for you to check it out. And once you get a chance, I want to see it again. Maybe we can have... maybe we can talk about that film together and I can revisit it, something like that down the road. But The Farewell, if it's playing in your area, highly, highly recommend. It's definitely worth watching. It's such a good film about family. And I think we might have to invoke it a little bit when we're talking about some other films, perhaps, down the road. But there's something else I checked out, Aziz Ansari's new Netflix special right now. Have you been hearing anything about this, Will?
Well, I just heard yesterday that Spike Jonze directed it, or is that false?
He did. Cool. And you can tell it's very different. A lot of the special has like a camera guy like right there up there in Aziz Ansari's face, so a lot of the time it's not a traditional special in the sense that you don't have these like flat shots of Aziz just sort of pacing the stage and doing his thing. The vast majority of this is him sitting on a stool, just sort of like talking into the camera, and not even talking to the camera, but like it's like at an angle. He's kind of talking to the audience. He's very quiet for a lot of this special. It's interesting in a filmmaking sort of way. Like you can tell that Spike Jonze wanted to do something a little bit different. You can tell it sort of fits in Ansari's toolbox, I guess, of like putting out some different thought-provoking things. This is the guy, of course, who did Master of None, and as someone who's never really been the biggest fan of his stand-up specials, I really liked Master of None, both of those seasons. But Ansari has been in quote unquote Me Too jail for the last year. So this was kind of a fascinating special because it was like his direct response to some issues that people raised. So Babe.net, which no longer exists, ran this piece.
Oh, really?
Well, it exists, but they shut it down. Yeah.
I didn't know they folded, so.
I highly recommend you check out this expose on what happened with Babe.net. Wonderful journalist Allison something, and I'm blanking on her last name. I don't want to guess wrong, but she wrote this whole expose on Babe.net, how it went out of business. Like, their HR, they didn't have HR, basically.
Okay.
And
that sounds all right, yeah.
Yeah, not great. What happened with that? That whole website, what went down with that? But they're sort of infamous because they had this piece go viral about this woman who went on a date with Aziz Ansari, and she told her story about it, and she said it was like the worst night of her life. He missed a lot of cues, and it raised this whole thing about consent. It wasn't straight up like sexual. It wasn't sexual assault by most people's definitions, but it definitely was this sort of thing of like Aziz Ansari sort of just not getting what consent really is and like how to basically be a good date. And he kind of went away for about a year. And he's definitely one of the people who, if anybody could have sort of like a comeback, who can sort of come back from this sort of thing and not be like canceled, I guess, forever. It was probably Aziz Ansari. He had a lot of support from a lot of celebrities, a lot of people saying like, hey, you know, yeah, this is something that unfortunately happens with a lot of guys. Doesn't make it right. It's something that if he apologizes and he shows like contrition about it, you know, he's somebody whose people can respect his art. And I've sort of been on that same page of like, yeah, he seems like the kind of person who means what he says when he talks about, you know, he wrote a book called Modern Romance. He talks a lot about how men should be respectful of women, and this happened on a date with him, and it's definitely pretty, it's a huge setback, you know, for his career. But more so, I think it's something that he talks about in the special being an opportunity to be able to talk about something that men don't usually talk about on dates, and that's like just how to be better stewards of other human beings and how to not make people uncomfortable and to put ourselves before other people. And he makes a point where he's like, a lot of people have told me that like they've thought about every date they've ever been on, a lot of men, just because of that story, and they could see themselves in it. So I went into this special really just being like, you know, I kind of want to see what Aziz has to say, and you know, maybe this is his chance. And without getting into too much detail, I was thoroughly disappointed with what Aziz had to say. I really think that he came off to me as angry, you know, kind of the quiet angry. You're not going to see him ranting and raving, but I saw him as sort of the undertone was, I didn't deserve this. And he talks about how he was humiliated and he was scared. He pays what I interpreted as lip service to, okay, well, you know, I shouldn't have done this. And that's how he like opens up the special. I've heard that like he tried to do the special without addressing any of this, and he got a lot of pushback. So for the special they were releasing on Netflix, he actually talks about it for like 5 minutes. And, you know, maybe I'm missing something. Maybe somebody had a different experience with this special. I didn't buy it. Like, I didn't buy it, especially because like afterward, you just get the sense that he's trying to shift the blame a little bit, or he's trying to like bring up other things that make him look better. This is a special where he talks about R. Kelly. This is a special where he talks about Michael Jackson and quote unquote woke white liberals. Then the white liberals thing is like right afterward. And it just felt very reactionary. It just felt like a guy who was like, who doesn't really think he did anything all that bad. And instead of kind of owning up to it in a way that maybe could advance his career forward, I just saw it as like, I mean, he like literally berates people in the audience the entire time, which I've never seen him do in a special. And I don't want to say it's a thoroughly bad special or anything like that. It's just one of those things where the optics are just not great. And I don't think it was funny enough to really justify what he was going for. There are definitely a few good laughs. There's some great points he brings up in here. There's a great set that he does about his grandmother that I found compelling. There's some interesting stuff about, you know, how things were doing now, you know, in 50 years, people are going to like look back on us and be like, you know, he kind of has this attitude of like, we're all terrible people. And some of that stuff was clicking, but I had a hard time just reckoning with the whole gear of this special. It just felt very defensive in a way that I thought he could do better in terms of reacting to a situation like this. And I don't know. I don't know if people are having different reactions, but I'm curious if you ever get a chance to see it. Will maybe I hope you have a different response. Or I hope I'm wrong about this. I want the best for somebody. I want him to, you know, grow, and I hope that I'm just missing something, and that he actually is, and that maybe I'm just, you know, reading into something that's not there. I hope that's the case.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not the biggest fan of Aziz Ansari. I don't even know if I would consider myself a fan. It doesn't really have anything to do with the controversy around him. I just never really found his comedy to be that funny, and I haven't watched Master of None, so I'm not really someone who can speak very much on Aziz Ansari's character or his comedy, but I do know that, based on what I heard about this special, that did seem promising in a way that you were suggesting earlier, like compared to another comedian I won't mention who has kind of been on the defensive in a way bigger way about some of the controversies that he has acquired. Oh, yeah. I feel like this special had a chance to be like, oh, it's like kind of reckoning and self-reflective in a way that I found intriguing. And obviously having Spike Jonze be involved as a director was something that was very intriguing to me, but hearing what you're saying is also making me not really want to check it out. So, yeah, I don't know if I'll check it out or not, but I'm usually not very good about Netflix specials in general, even the ones I do want to see, so there's a very high chance I might just not get a chance to see this one, but who knows? I might put it on one of these days.
Yeah, if there's anybody that I really want to talk to about the special, it is Maverick Hines, because he was the one I always like to watch and discuss specials with. But I have no clue if he's going to be able to check it out anytime soon. But with that, let's get into some of our comments from last week. We got a really good question from Timmy W, who asked, what movies do you think stand a chance at the 2020 Oscars? So films that are coming out this year that could be Best Picture and things like that. There are a few, but I just want to raise attention to one that I think I think is undoubtedly going to be nominated for Best Picture and clean up a few other awards as well, probably, at least nomination-wise, and that's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, the Quentin Tarantino film that, yeah, I think you're excited to see. I'm excited to see. It comes out in a couple weeks. I don't see how this doesn't get... It's like it's got Oscars written all over it. It's one of those films that, you know, didn't get super well received at Cannes, but in the way that usually spells promise for Best Picture, honestly. So was there anything else though, Will, that you think might be able to sneak in there?
Just based on what we've seen so far this year, you think?
Maybe that, and also like what's about to come out. Cause you know, I've looked at some of the things that are coming out, and there's like Harriet, the biopic that I think probably has some Oscar-ness to it, but I haven't taken a really deep, serious look at yeah, the contenders coming up, because been so focused on the summer, so.
Right, I don't know, I mean, I do very much wonder if Us is going to get some award attention later in the year, at least sure, for yeah, Lupita. I don't think it'll quite get the same showing as Get Out, just because I think the film has proven to be a little more divisive, I guess, compared to his first film, and so I could maybe see that getting in, maybe not. I could see The Farewell, from what I've heard, getting some awards attention. I don't know if yeah, A24 will give it the push, or they'll try to put their attention to something else. But
I think it'll get a Best Supporting Actress, probably.
That's good to hear.
At the very least.
Or screenplay or something.
Screenplay could definitely get something, because it's an original screenplay, and Lulu Wang, you know, depending on what comes out next, I would very much like to see her get a nomination for Best Director. Mm-hmm. There's also Greta Gerwig's Little Women, which
yeah, could that's true,
be a little promising. If we're talking about people who are established in the Academy, that's someone who, yeah.
Yeah, and I have heard, I mean, nothing official, but I have heard some rumblings from Little Women, people who've seen test screenings, and it's very positive right now. So oh, that's definitely encouraging to hear, and I'm looking forward to seeing that, and I think that does have a very good chance of appealing to the Academy for sure.
Right, right. And I think some people have been trying to say that The Lion King is going to have...
For what, visual effects?
Visual effects, yeah. And then some people were trying to say that it may be Best Animated Feature. I know you're on that train. It is interesting. I could see Lion King get nominated for Best Animated. But the thing is, Disney wouldn't submit it that way, so yeah, it won't get nominated. But it probably is the best animation, or the, you know, because I'm thinking of other animated films of the year, and I like Toy Story 4 a lot, but...
That's what I was going to say.
Sequels tend to not, and then you have to look at, like, How to Train Your Dragon 3, Lego Movie 2, Ugly Dolls, there's not a Secret Life of Pets 2, there are not a lot of animated films this year. Missing Link, maybe?
Yeah, maybe Lego Movie. You said Lego Movie 2. Yeah. Yeah, I do wonder though, because that is a good point. Because Toy Story 3, if I remember correctly, was also nominated for Best Picture, right?
It was. It's one of the only animated films to be nominated, and an animated movie hasn't been nominated since.
Yeah. So I don't know. I mean, I don't know if it'll quite. I don't think it's catched the same fire as Toy Story 3 per se, though it has been very well received. There is a slight chance, I think, that that might get into the Best Picture conversation, but I don't know. I feel like for a lot of people...
No. It's not going to be nominated for Best Picture. There's
you don't
no
think
way.
So? It's like definitive, you think?
I don't think it stands a chance. I think the reason Toy Story 3 was nominated was because of its finality.
Right.
I think it was received well in a different way. Toy Story 4 has great reviews, but I don't think it's nowhere near as like critically beloved. Because it's all about how things look with the Oscars, and like a fourth film that isn't really wrapping up a trilogy, I don't see the campaign there, but I do see it winning Best Animated because by sheer merit. I mean, that's all it really is, and I think a lot of people didn't see Missing Link, so they're not going to vote for that. That's probably the best original animated film. That's not a sequel, but that's basically because there aren't a lot of other ones at all besides like Ugly Dolls. And did Wonder Park come out this year too, if I recall?
So, yeah, it did.
Yeah, so it's kind of a bleak year for animated films that aren't sequels, and even then, box office wise, it's been kind of bleak for them, with the exception of Toy Story 4. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, definitely, it does seem at this moment that Toy Story 4 has the award in its grasp, so I guess we'll see. Unless there's some movie coming up that I'm completely forget about or don't know about that's going to, like, sweep us all off our feet, it's highly possible, because I know the market for animated, like, their category, they tend to be pretty global, so there's a chance that there are some films that will be nominated that we just don't know about yet or are not made aware of yet. So
there's a few I've heard and I'm just forgetting what they are, but they're it's exactly what you're saying. It's like once the trailer comes out and then they're going to show a TIFF and then we're going to be like, oh yeah, of course. Like this is the Oscar movie of this year. It's just a matter of time until that happens.
Yeah. So we'll see. Yeah. I mean, the answer to the question though, it's just so early. It's like literally the midpoint of the year. That, like, even the films that we think could have a chance, it's so unclear at this point that, you know, like, who knows? Like, we don't know what's going to happen in, like, 8 months from now, let alone 6 months. Or I guess that would be 8 months before the Academy Awards happen. So, you know, there's so many factors that can go into play. I mean, nothing is, a proven guaranteed nominee at this point. But, yeah, it does seem, if there's a chance that something or another is going to get nominated, it does seem like you said, like, Little Women, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, maybe The Farewell. What were some other ones we mentioned? I feel like those ones are have a pretty good chance of getting nominated, but
those are the main ones. I think Us stands a pretty good chance of getting some nominations, like you mentioned, but it is one of those years where we don't have a lot of films like A Quiet Place, for example, that have already come out that are more mainstream that get a lot of attention. I don't know if Rocketman is going to get any attention the way Bohemian Rhapsody did. So I think it is a confusing year because it hasn't been as strong a year for mainstream blockbusters, at least critically, and in a lot of ways financially too. So I think a lot of our Oscar movies have yet to come out. So that's probably the case. And what tends to happen in years like this, because, you know, it's not the first time we've had a bit of a down year, you know, quality-wise. What tends to happen is when it's like blood in the water for studios, they'll screen things at TIFF that'll do really well, and then they'll dump tons of movies in December because they're like, oh, this is one of those years where, you know, there's no Get Out, there's no Quiet Place. Yeah. We can try to put in this film that we were maybe thinking of releasing next year, and we can do it now, and then hopefully that's going to get us a nomination and a great January, February theatrical run to make some of that sweet cash.
But also, we also have to take into account that Netflix is very heavily trying to get into the Oscar game this year. Right. If it is a down year, then they're really going to push for it, especially with The Irishman, the Martin Scorsese.
Oh, yes. I'm glad because that was another one of the ones that I was like, okay, that's definitely got Oscar written all over it. It's not Triple Frontier. we'll put it that way.
Yeah, because they're in a very weird place right now, because Netflix is like, they don't want to spend as much on original properties, but they also very much want to be respected as a movie studio in the way that they're pretty much respected at the Emmys as a TV studio. So, yeah, I do think that they're really going to push into The Irishman. Maybe they have a couple others up their sleeves I don't know about, or I'm forgetting about at the moment, that they're going to push. But I do think if there is a down year, they're really going to go for some Oscars this year.
I think that's the case. I think A24 probably has a few things they want to throw in there along with The Farewell.
And Amazon.
And Amazon. I mean, Amazon's big high-profile acquisition was Late Night. I don't think that's going to be showing up anytime soon. But yeah, I think that Last Black Man in San Francisco possibly could get a couple of different attentions. And there are a few other A24 things. I think High Life probably doesn't qualify based on its release date, but it could get something.
I think it qualifies, yeah. I just don't know. I feel like that movie wouldn't really be the Academy's thing. I don't want to assume, but it just like...
Well, Claire Denis tends to not be the Academy's thing.
Right, that's what I mean. So that's the other factor. It's like, it's not merely that it's a good film. Like, it has to be good by the Academy standards. Or it doesn't even have to be good. It just has to be to the Academy standards. So, it's just very much like, you know, it's you have to think in their mindset, so that's kind of complicated. But, yeah, there's a lot of films, I think, that are coming out that could easily fit into the Academy's wheelhouse. But for now, yeah, it seems like the ones we mentioned are the most likely to get some attention.
Always a good reminder of how the Oscars work, and I think we can leave it at that since we've got plenty of time to worry about all the awards and things like that. We had a few other comments. Bane was asking about some Midsummer discussions because this was before the Midsummer episode came out. Again, that bonus pod is out. Year One said, surprise you guys didn't rank your favorite Spider-Man films. For me, the first Raimi film was the gold standard. Which I know is probably a hot take, considering everyone else loves Spider-Man 2 more. It's got the perfect camp and energy, and it's the best origin story we've seen for the character on screen. I think that's interesting. I think Spider-Man 2 has a better villain. It's got better effects. I think it has better set pieces. And just that dramatic flair that Spider-Man 2 has, I think that's why people routinely put it over the first Spider-Man. But yeah, we like the first Spider-Man. It's a good movie.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I tend to think of it as... I mean, it's kind of similar in the same ways to the Richard Donner's Superman movies in that, like, I really enjoy that first movie, but I feel like the second one, Superman 2, really, you know, builds upon that and adds some interesting ideas and themes. And I think that's the same for Spider-Man 1, too, which I really enjoy Spider-Man 1. I'd probably put it in my top five for Spider-Man movies. But yeah, I just think Spider-Man 2 is probably the best one for a variety of reasons that you mentioned and several others.
Agreed. Okay, last one. Do you guys plan on seeing Art of Self-Defense and Farewell? Yes, that is the answer to that. We're talking about Art of Self-Defense this week, and hopefully once you see Farewell, we'll talk about that again soon. But those are our comments. If you want to weigh in, definitely go to cinemaholics.com and check out our latest episodes and let us know what's on your mind in the comment section. All right, let's get into one of our featured reviews. We have a triple feature this week, starting with Crawl.
Come here, Pete. I need your coffee. Pete, do you hear that?
So Crawl is kind of a... You sort of described it earlier. It's like it's a disaster film in one sense because there's this big hurricane in Gainesville, Florida. And I think it's Gainesville. That's where she goes to school in Gainesville. Her father lives in like this swampy area. And there's a Category 5 hurricane that is sweeping this area. It's flooding the area. And our main character, played by Kaia Scodelario, her name is Haley, and she has sort of an estranged relationship with her father. It's a bit more recent. She is part of the University of Florida swim team. That's going to come in handy. And
the Gators.
Yeah, that's right. Her dad was her coach, but she comes kind of from like a newly broken family. Her father is played by Barry Pepper, and her sister FaceTimes her and is like, hey, you know, she lives up in Boston. She's like, haven't heard from dad. And so everyone's a little bit worried. So she goes down and she tries to see what's going on with her father, finds out that he is trapped in a crawl space. And here's the catch. There are alligators everywhere that have come in from the lake next to their house, which being somebody who has a lot of family in Florida, I've lived in Florida, that is very realistic. There is absolutely nothing fantastical about the idea of alligators going through a drain pipe and getting into people's houses. That is just kind of a thing that happens in Florida, and it's pretty terrifying. And what makes it even more terrifying is because of this hurricane, there is a flood. And that means there are alligators hunting people, in the streets. And I, let me tell you, Will, from the trailers to me sitting in this theater, I was so ready for this movie. I was so ready for something this nail-biting to happen on screen. This was directed by Alexandra Aja, who did The Hills Have Eyes and Horns and what am I, Mirrors? What else am I missing?
High Tension.
High Tension. That was his first film.
And then didn't he do Piranha?
Piranha 3D, yes. Thank you.
Yeah.
I knew I was missing one. Yeah, so Alexandra Aja, and this is from Raimi Productions. So Sam Raimi produced,
yeah.
And he owns a Ghost House Pictures. And I love Sam Raimi. As you know, we just talked about Sam Raimi's Spider-Man movies. And
yeah, one of my favorite filmmakers.
He's such a great filmmaker. I'm always interested in anything he has his hand in. But yes, Crawl, simple story, simple premise, but it's definitely one of those premises that you just... It just makes so much sense for a movie. Like, that's a movie I want to see. It's like you have this idea, like, as the water is rising, the alligators get more access to areas that where they can hunt these people who are trying to survive. And I really enjoyed this film. I think it's pretty good. I think it reminded me of, it's a kind of like summer horror, you know, edge of your seat film. It reminded me of Don't Breathe, the Fede, I always butcher his last name, but... Fede Alvarez or something like that.
Yeah, Fede Alvarez, yeah.
Who did Don't Breathe in 2016, where it's just such
and,
a...
Evil Dead.
And Evil, the Evil Dead remake. And he does such
Sam Raimi produced.
It's such a simple premise that, like, you feel bottled into this one area, and you really hurt for these characters. And this is one of the few films I've seen in a while where I had to, like, close my eyes at certain points, not because I was scared of what was happening, but because I was so scared for these characters. What was your reaction to this film, Will? Did you have fun with this?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I, similar to you, was excited just because it seemed like a very, like, tight-knit premise that I enjoy, especially in the summer, where it's just, like, you know, like, it's like a lean, mean 87 minutes. It's, like, no frills. There's nothing, like, bigger going on here. It's just, like, woman versus... alligator in a house. Like, that's basically it. Like, there's nothing else going on. Yeah, during a hurricane. Yeah, it's like, that's enough. Like, you know, there's enough conflict there. And, like, only a couple moments I feel like, yeah, this is kind of getting stretched out a bit. Like, for the most part, like, the film is pretty good about staying consistent with the pacing and also, like, just giving us enough information to keep us going while, like, providing just enough, like, believability in there. Like, I mean, believability is kind of a strong word for this movie, but like, just enough, like, you can go along with what's going on, what's happening, like, enough where you can follow, not like you're like, why are you doing this, or like, what's going on here. Like, it's just enough to keep you in the mindset of the characters. And to me, like, it's interesting because we watched Alien for Extra Milestone like last month, and it's like, that's kind of a B movie as well, but that's like an A B movie, if that makes sense, like an A quality B movie.
Yeah.
And we've seen, like, several B movies that are, like, C to D level, sometimes F level. But to me, this is, like, a B movie that's, like, B level quality. Like, it's just, like, a solid, like, yeah, pretty well-produced, like, well-made movie that's, like, not amazing. Like, the script is definitely pretty hackneyed at times. Like, the beginning of the film definitely has some weak writing as far as character development and some exposition dumps that are, like, not at all subtle. In a way that I guess you could kind of almost expect from, like, an Salem movie or something. But, yeah, I think once the actual premise gets going along and you kind of are given the gist as far as, like, who the central players are, where they are in the house, like, what's going on outside the house, and what the conflict is, and it's just like, there you go, and let's have some fun. And it just goes from there. I think it's pretty solid. It has, like, I think it has more of a sense of humor than some critics I've seen suggest. Like, it has kind of like a...
I was definitely laughing a lot.
Yeah, it has a cheeky sense of humor, but at the same time, it plays it straight. Like, it doesn't have, like, this ironic tone as far as, like, oh, it's a croc, or it's an alligator movie, and it's, like, not, like, you know, like, not trying to act better than it. Like, it's not trying to say, like, you know, like, how fun it is for us to, like, you know, make a B-movie with a $13 million budget. Like, it's, like, pretty serious about, like, hey, you know, like, we're gonna stay... rigid to the premise. Like, we're not gonna, like, try and make this bigger than it is, but at the same time, like, it is kind of goofy and silly in a way that isn't quite on Piranha 3D's level, where, like, that is, like, basically, like, a comedy. But I do think it is, like, kind of, like, cheeky in a sense of way, in a way that keeps it fun and keeps it, like, moving while not, like, getting bogged down into you know, like, self-seriousness, while also, I guess, respecting the characters and, you know, what they're going through here, even though the motivation is pretty simple and, you know, you could write it down in, like, less than a paragraph. And I do think it helps that the performers in here, Barry Pepper and Kylie, how do you pronounce her last name?
Scodelario.
Scodelario. They are, you know, they're playing pretty well. And I do think their performances are strong and you can believe their relationship as a father and daughter. So I think a lot of these different factors help to make, you know, what could have been a pretty easily disposable throwaway film into something, you know, pretty enjoyable and well made.
I think you're going to hate me for saying this, but I think it takes itself seriously, but not literally. And sure. that's probably the worst way to describe it. But yeah, I was laughing, but I was laughing in a way that wasn't at the expense of the characters. Like, this isn't Drag Me to Hell. It's not that kind of thing.
Well, no, it's not great.
I agree with you there. I really enjoy that movie. But I mean, in the sense where Drag Me to Hell is really tongue in cheek. I mean, it's really going for a larger than life sort of thing. I appreciate that it's a bit, no pun intended, grounded in terms of very simple stakes, very simple understanding. Like, there is that exposition, but it's easy to understand. And I really enjoy a horror film that's not about grief. It's about something else.
Yeah.
I was really worried it was going to be one of those things where it's like, all right, mom died, didn't she? No, she doesn't. Mom is just divorced and her dad is just dealing with an empty nest. Okay, that's great. That to me is like such an easy way into caring about these characters, but also it not being schmaltzy because they do have a few issues. And there were parts of this movie that, Will, where I was laughing just because of like the random times when they would bring up their issues. It was like the worst times possible. And there are a few instances where characters are doing things in here where I'm like, get out of the water. You are just sort of standing in the water. You don't have to stand in the water where you know there are alligators. You could get onto, you see those, you see that little elevation there? You just get on there and then you can do the thing you're doing right now. There are a few moments like that, but aside from them, which were very frustrating, I was very much thinking these are smart characters who are very skilled at swimming and maneuvering. And if there was any criticism I had that really prevents this from being an outright terrific film, I think it's probably the crawl space design. I had a hard time understanding how that setting worked. It felt a little inconsistent of like where things were, and I never had a really good sense of that location. And we spend a long time in that crawl space. I think the movie is much better served when they're outside of it. And I was a little disappointed that most of the film is in there, and you don't get enough of the film that you see in the trailers, which give away a lot. By the way, I think we were talking about this yesterday. They really spell out like what happens in this film in terms of outside of the house. And I really wish they hadn't, because I wish the film had done more stuff in the house at proper. If it had, I think there could have been more room for some creative stuff, but there was an effectiveness to being trapped in a crawl space with alligators. That was a very dreadful atmosphere that they created. And I was a big fan. I think, I'm right there with you. I think this is a B movie. So I give this one a B. What about you?
I'm going to give it a B minus just because I'm not quite, I don't think I'd go out of my way to say it's like a good film, but it is enjoyable for what it is. I had fun watching it. And I do think a lot of the elements here that are well done elevate what I think is kind of like a like so-so script, maybe even less than so-so at times, into being something that is highly enjoyable and, you know, engaging for the short amount of time that you're in the theater to watch it. And I do think, you know, for a summer film like this, that's not a franchise film, not a sequel in any way, just, you know, it is what it is, and it's coming out, and hopefully people are going to check it out. It's a lot of fun. And so, I'm going to give it a firm B-.
Well, we'll probably have to expect Crawl 2 coming out in 2021, based on how things are going. But this film might make some money.
I was going to ask real quick. So you said you've lived in Florida before.
Yeah.
Aren't crawl spaces in Florida like kind of rare, given like the flooding? Or is that
I didn't have a house, so
okay,
I don't really know. we never had a house or anything. I've lived in apartments in Florida, I've lived in condos, and I've been to houses in Florida, and I want to say I've never seen a basement there for obvious reasons.
Right.
So I guess crawl spaces, it's not as big of a deal because that can flood, and I think it's supposed to flood, and I don't know. I'm not really sure how common that tends to be, but I'm sure it's common in some areas. Yeah.
And to be fair, like, this house seemed to be built like a while ago. So in the logic of the film, I guess this maybe was like a very old house that, you know, was built before they really thought about flooding and stuff, I guess. But
maybe.
I don't know. So I just wasn't sure about that.
But like you said, lean 87 minutes, which I appreciated, and perfect length. And I think this film might make a little bit of money. It's got a budget of $13.5 million. Thursday previews are all we have so far in box office and made about $1 million, which means it'll probably make about $13 million this weekend. That's on the overestimation side. If it makes any more, that's going to be a huge anomaly. But yeah, I mean, realistically, this is looking like $10 to $13 million on its first week, which is great. If you can make, for a film like this, if you can make your budget back on the first week, you're sold, you're solid. You know, from there, you can just start to pay off the marketing and then start making a profit for Paramount.
Yeah, I was going to say, Paramount is definitely in the black, or not in the black, I guess they're in the red for the most part at this point in time. And they have, you know, they have like A Quiet Place and some other films that have helped them. But yeah, any success they can have is definitely a win for them.
Right. I mean, I'm thinking, you know, last year was kind of a mixed bag for them. You know, they had Mission Impossible, that the new one, Fallout. That film certainly did super well for them. But then, you know, Bumblebee didn't do as well as I think they were hoping, I want to say. And it's been a little tough for them in the last year, as you mentioned. But yeah, we'll see how things go for them the rest of this year. I don't know off the top of my head what else they have coming out. I'm sure I'm due, but I'm just forgetting. But
oh, Terminator. And Sonic. Yeah.
Well, that got delayed to next year, right?
Right. So it is coming up still, yes. But yeah, that is a film in the works.
Yeah, and they're also doing stuff with Netflix, we should say. I know they're doing a sequel to All the Boys I've Loved Before, which they're making for Netflix. Okay. So I have a feeling, yeah, that's been going on ever since like Annihilation and Cloverfield Paradox. I think I definitely see Paramount and Netflix cozying up together a little bit more. And yeah, so Crawl has a Rotten Tomato score of 88% so far, which is really good.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
Well, it's weird because it wasn't screened for critics. So it only, yeah, there are only 60 reviews out. So that's a little bit surprising. But yeah, I think that it's, people are liking it. I think its cinema score was like a B minus, something like that, which I was surprised by. I thought this would be more like an A minus sort of cinema score because you see the trailer for this and you go see this movie, you get exactly what you paid for. So I'm surprised.
Exactly, yeah.
I'm surprised it's not clicking with some of the cinema score audiences so far, some of that early polling, but who knows if this will have some legs, some small legs, and if it will crawl its way to a profit, we'll see. But that is Crawl. Let's talk about Stuber.
Hey! Uber?
Yeah. Hey, let me guess, you want me to drive you to all the Sarah Connors in the city?
Come on, start it up, let's go.
Oh, it's already started. Electric car. I call it silent but deadly.
Drive.
I'm Stu, how do you do? Can I get you some bottled water, some Canadian chocolates? It was one of those things where I thought I was getting 5 bars on Amazon, but I ended up getting
Koreatown, now.
Koreatown? Now. Hold on, I'm gonna bang a Yui here real quick. Nope, don't got it. Hold on. Oh, didn't quite make it. Just a couple more points and we got it.
Stuber is a new R-rated buddy action comedy that takes place in L.A. About time we saw a buddy comedy in L.A. I've been just waiting and waiting for some filmmaker to have the courage to choose L.A. as a location to put the LAPD on the big screen. Can you imagine, Will Ashton? We can finally see.
Next, I'll have the NYPD on the big screen. Can you imagine that?
maybe on television. We can finally learn about how the NYPD is about law. It's about order. It's
exactly.
Yeah, so this is a new film directed by Michael Dowds, the director of What If and Goon. And this is from a screenplay from Tripper Clancy, who I'm not aware of. I've never heard of Tripper Clancy before this. But the film stars Camille Nanjiani, Dave Bautista, Iko Uwe from The Raid, Natalie Morales, Betty Gilpin, Mia Sorvino, Karen Gillan. Lots of good actors in this movie. It's about an Uber driver who, he's played by Camille Nanjiani. He just wants a 5-star rating. He has put all of his money into this business with a woman who just... He knows that he's friend-zoned with, but he's hoping that it can turn into something. And then one day, because he's just got LASIK eye surgery, Dave Bautista, who plays this cop, comes into his Uber and tells him to go to Koreatown and just sort of whips him unwillingly into a grand adventure across Los Angeles in order to defeat this criminal who is selling heroin to kids. Terrible. And I'm just saying the movie is terrible. I do not like this movie. I'm very sad because this was produced by Jonathan Goldstein and John Francis Daley, who did... They were co-writers on Spider-Man Homecoming. Very funny movie. I think they directed or wrote Game Night, I want to say. They were heavily involved in the creativity behind Game Night. John Francis Daley, you'll recognize from Freaks and Geeks. And, well, was this supposed to be funny? Because as an action movie, I didn't think it was very good action. Very shaky. Very hard to follow what was going on. And as a comedy... I did think it was very funny, save for a couple of standout moments. And you know what it really is? I just didn't like the characters in Stuber. I didn't care about them, and I didn't like them. I didn't think there was much to like about them. Where were you at with Stuber?
Not far behind you. I was... I don't know if I was really looking forward to this movie, but I was more optimistic than anything because not so much John Francis Daley and who's the other guy in that pair?
Jonathan Goldstein,
yeah. I'm not really crazy about them, their work besides Game Night and Spider-Man Homecoming. I think everything else they've been involved in from a creative standpoint, as far as writing and directing, has been pretty bad, in my view. But, Michael Dowsey, I mean, he hasn't made a great film, but Goon and What If are pretty solid, you know, good comedies. Like, they're not amazing, you know, I don't think you think about them much after you watch them, but they're solid and they're enjoyable. And I was like, you know, the cast here, Dave Bautista, Kamel Nanjiani, like, you know, there could be something here to this, even though the premise is nothing really remarkable. And unfortunately, similar to you, I just found myself pretty much just frustrated throughout most of this movie. I mean, I think I enjoyed Dave Bautista a little more than you did, just because I think he just brings a good energy to anything he does. And I think it's clear that he just loves acting, and he likes that he's now respected as an actor, and he can do big films like this and, you know, really just have fun in a comedy, and I respect that. But I feel like, yeah, I mean, even though I'm happy for Kamel Nanjiani that he's able to headline a big comedy like this, I feel like his character was written in a way that, like, a baby boomer would write a millennial character, and that,
spot on.
Yeah, like, he, like, very much felt like a parody of a, like, triggered millennial, and, like, how they would respond to, like, all this, like, 80s action. And I don't know, maybe if they did something with that, maybe if, like, Jody Hill did, like, a comedy like this, and they, like, really leaned into the darkness of it, they could make something that's, you know, kind of fun and, like, commenting on, like, the tropes of the 80s comedies. But I feel like this movie really just, it just felt like it was playing it, like, not safe, but just kind of basic in a way that didn't really elevate the material and didn't really provide the necessary, like, tenets to what would make, I think, a comedy work, even though, like, there are things in here that do work. Like, I don't think they have bad chemistry together. I think it's, like, okay chemistry. Like, I think a good script could have maybe elevated that or something. But, like you said, like, the characters themselves are so inherently flawed and so ultimately unlikable that you don't really enjoy spending time with them, and you don't really want them to succeed because you're just not that enamored by them to begin with. And, I mean, I do enjoy, like, the ideas that are put in here. Like, I think having, the guy from The Raid come in and, you know, like, having Dave Bautista play, you know, like, a big, larger-than-life character in this kind of world could have been really fun, like, in the way that, you know, like, a lot of movies with The Rock have kind of leaned into his physicality. Or even John Cena with Blockers and a couple other movies that he's done. Like, that could have worked, I think, if done well, but unfortunately, yeah, this movie just, it just doesn't really work for me, unfortunately.
Right, it's all about the execution, I think, with this movie. I think you have an opportunity here, like you said, to... It wants to be that 80s action, buddy action comedy, and it tries to, but I think the problem with that is it's just sort of riffing off of that material. It's never improving it. It's never updating it. This very much felt, I think the way it thinks it's updating it is by making Kamel Nanjiani, yeah, like you're saying, that sort of millennial snowflake sort of character. And the problem with that is there's nothing really interesting about a character like that because it's not a very relatable or realistic character in the first place.
Right. It's like a sitcom character.
I mean, the tagline for this movie literally is "Saving the day takes a pair." I mean, it's just so ultra masculine, and I think masculine in a way that has no bite to it, ironically, because you watch Dave Bautista flounder throughout a lot of this film, not being able to be masculine because he can't see, and he already has that as a foil, So then when you add Camille Nanjiani as his other foil, it's so much. It's just so much of like these two characters not being able to operate and really work together. And I think it would, if just one department of this film had been slightly better in terms of like, if the action had been better, the comedy had been better, I think this could have been a lot of fun. This could have been a very, you know, disposable sort of comedy, but definitely not something you struggle to watch. I struggled to get through this. I was really done with it at a certain point.
It's only like 90 minutes.
I felt longer. A lot of that is because it is one of those movies where you know what's going to happen before it happens. You know how things are going to turn out. You know what they're setting up. There are a few elements in here that I thought were interesting. I thought, for example, this idea that Camille Nanjiani, he's in the friend zone, but it's not that simple. It's not like nothing's ever happened between him and this woman. Mm-hmm. It actually goes a little bit deeper than that. And there was kind of an interesting story element there. It's just, the framing of it is all wrong because you're really just watching. It makes him unlikable because you're watching him sort of be like, I got to go, you know, I got to get out of this situation so I can go hook up with this girl. And it's just like, well, lives are on the line. Like, why are you so obsessed with this? But then at the same time, you're like, but also he's a civilian. And I just had a hard time really going along for the ride with this. But let's talk a little bit about Camille Nanjiani and Dave Bautista since you touched upon it. I like Dave Bautista a lot. I think as Drax Destroyer, he's been fantastic. I thought that his scene in Blade Runner 2049, one of my favorite scenes of the film, one of the best action scenes of that year. And in this movie, something was missing. Do you think it was the writing for him? Because I don't think it's him as an actor.
Right. No, I think it is the writing ultimately, because like you said, like I think he is committing to the material. I think he plays the character as well as he can. But yeah, just like, constantly scene after scene, like the jokes just don't really work. Like even like sometimes when a joke is like okay, it just feels so few and far between that it's just like it has to be the material, because obviously like I said, they're doing what they can. I think they have decent chemistry. It's just that like the jokes just don't work. And again, like you were saying earlier, like I think the action doesn't really benefit either. Like it's like the set pieces they have are interesting, like that hotel thing, the hotel scene, even though I think that's the same hotel from Blockers.
It looks just like it. It really looks like it.
I think I've seen another movie there too. Like I think Wish Upon was also shot there. So I guess there's something about that hotel that really sparks a lot of interest for film producers. But
yeah, right by the Staples Center.
Oh, you know what the hotel is?
No, but you see the Staples Center in that scene. So
oh, I see. You know that. Okay. Yeah. But it just feels like the action of that scene, like you have Dave Bautista and the guy from The Raid, and it's like, this should be a great action scene. And it's just like all shaky cam. You can barely see what's going on. And like, I don't know if they're like trying to mimic that he can't really see or like what's going on in that scene, but just from a directorial standpoint, unfortunately, it just doesn't really work. And it's just like that scene to me was like when the moment was like, oh, this is going to be bad. Like, this is not going to work as a movie. Just like even before Camille Nanjiani came on, I was just like, if this scene's not really working, then I can't really have faith in the rest of the movie. And unfortunately, that proved to be true by the end.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that part of what you're saying with the material for Bautista is that they're almost writing him to be like this older baby boomer character, even though he doesn't look very old. Like he's about 50 years old, but they sort of write him as this like 65-year-old, like 2 days from retirement, you know, the kids today.
Probably was like written for like Bruce Willis or something. And he turned it down.
I wouldn't be surprised, because that feels like a better fit for as his character as he's written. Because, I mean, his daughter is like in her 30s. So, like, it's just weird. And they never address how weird his age is in this movie, because he's supposed to not understand Uber. But I don't know. There was something really lost in translation with that character. And then, we can talk about Camille Nanjiani, who I think has proven in films like The Big Sick that he is hilarious. I mean, he's a funny actor. But then you put him in these movies like this and Men in Black International, and it's just, I don't know what's going on. Like, I'm really starting to worry that he's just sort of being put into this category or this box as a comedic actor that definitely doesn't realize his true talents, because you like him so much in Big Sick because of his like sort of deadpan delivery, but then his like observations on real life. He has sort of like a foothold in reality. Where in this movie, it's just he's as heightened as the situations happening around him, and there's a lot of overacting, and it just doesn't work, I think, for either this movie or this actor. And I'll say too, even as an LA movie, I was really let down in weird ways by like it rains in this movie in LA. Like it rains after a heat wave. Like there are just these weird things. It's like, and there are just little touches where I'm like, I don't know. It just felt like very contrived. Certain things happen in this movie for the sake of it and not in any sense that feels like believable or feels like a world that you want to be inside of for about an hour and a half.
I don't know. It just feels like so much this movie's like halfway there. Like you were saying, like it just feels like so much like maybe there's something you could do with like Kamel and Johnny and like the five stars he's constantly craving. Like, I don't know, like maybe like something with entitlement and millennials or something. But it doesn't really feel like it's like they establish enough that like his job's on the line with the five stars. It's like it's an understandable concern. So it's like I don't know. It just feels like they either threw too much into this movie or not enough. Like, I don't know which direction they need to take it to make it work, but it just feels like it's kind of stuck in, like, one spot, and it can't really move beyond that to the point where it's just, like, kind of, like, in that consistently middling ground for so much of the movie that it's just frustrating to watch.
Yeah, I think that's right. So for this film, I gave it a very generous C. I think it could have been lower, but you know, it's not all bad. There's some things here that are interesting. It's almost a C+. I could see myself kind of going back and forth, but yeah, for now, it's definitely a C. I have no interest in seeing this film again, but what about you?
Yeah, I'm right there with you. I gave it a C as well. Yeah, it just feels like, I don't know, like, it's not boring to watch. Like, it's not like a dull film per se, but it's just so frustrating and annoying in how it just kind of chooses to settle in what it could have been. And I guess, like, it just kind of coasts on being, like, this 80s type comedy with, like, some modern flourishes in it that, yeah, it just feels like they could have done more legwork to really make it work. And unfortunately, they just settled on it being, like, fine. And to me, that made it worse. So, yeah, I just gave it a C.
I'm surprised this was the film that was screened for critics. And this is the film that came out at South by Southwest. But Crawl, which critics actually liked, like, we didn't see that. And, like, we didn't get any invitations to that. And they were, like, almost trying to hide it.
And that would have been a great South by Southwest movie.
Oh, 100%. So, yeah, kind of a bit of a bizarro world at the moment. But that's Stuber. This is another film that's only expected to make maybe about $10 million or so at the box office. I don't know how much the budget is. I don't think it's been released yet. But I don't know if it looks all that good for this film, at this point at least. And I don't know. I don't know what's going on with Bautista. Like, I'm kind of worried now that he's kind of going along the same roles as, like, The Rock back in, like, the late 2000s, early 2010s. Like, he even has his own version of The Game Plan coming out in a couple of months, or next month, actually. Mm-hmm. The one where it's, like, Spy something. I
My forget Spy, the name, yeah.
Maybe. My Spy, yeah. Where that film just looks very hackneyed and weird. And, like, I hope it's good, but, yeah.
I think what it honestly is that he is in a position where he is finally getting these roles and he's just accepting as many as he can because he's just so happy to work and to be like a working actor, you know, because of middle age and stuff. Like he wanted to be like an actor before, and I think he kind of just settled into wrestling and it did well for him. But now after Guardians of the Galaxy, he's actually, you know, being considered in many like respects as like a, you know, box office draw or like a lead actor. And so I think he just takes as many as he can. And, you know, the material is often going to wane, but he has Dune coming up, which I think is hopefully going to put him in a good film again, hopefully.
Yeah, but I mean, I guess it's just funny that didn't he like trash talk the Fast and Furious movies at one point?
He did.
So it's kind of funny to me that.
And The Rock.
Yeah, yeah. He would do that and be like, oh, I want to be in good movies. And then he's in Stuber. But anyway.
Right.
That's Stuber. We weren't fans, but we have one last film to talk about before we finish out this episode.
Well, you came to the right place. You're learning karate. You're a blade, and I'm sharpening you. But there's a mental component as well.
You mean like believing in myself?
Yeah, that won't hurt. I'm talking about something a little different. What's your favorite style of music?
Adult contemporary?
No. Should be metal. You ever listen to metal?
You mean like hard rock?
Metal is much more aggressive than hard rock. From now on, you'll listen to metal.
Yeah.
It's the toughest music there is. What about hobbies? Is there anything that you feel particularly passionate about? other than your newfound passion for metal?
I enjoy France.
The Art of Self-Defense. This premiered at South by Southwest as well. It's a dark as black coffee comedy. It was written and directed by Riley Stearns, who I wasn't as familiar with going into this film. I looked him up right after, and I wasn't familiar with the other things that he's worked on. Do you know about this writer-director, Will?
Didn't he do Fault?
He did, yeah.
Yeah, I've heard about Fault. I didn't see it, though.
This is his second film.
He was married to Mary Elizabeth Winstead for a moment.
Yeah.
I know that, too. So that's the only thing I really know about the filmmaker.
That's right. And he, yeah, Faults was his first film. It was from a few years ago. And I think he's been a screenwriter for a while. And this is his new film. It's like an indie movie. It stars Jesse Eisenberg, Alessandro Nivola, and Imogen Poots. And I went into this film not really knowing what the critical reaction to it was. I think that I'd heard maybe like, oh, it's interesting. I hadn't heard like effusive praise. I hadn't heard anything really negative.
I remember, like, it did premiere at South by Southwest, and the response was kind of like, I don't know what we make. Like, it was just kind of like, I remember, like, the response is kind of like a shrug.
I missed all that. So I wasn't aware until after I saw the film what the response was after that festival.
Yeah, I mean, maybe I'm just not remembering correctly, but I know, like, I think it was, like, kind of squeezed in between, like, two big premieres, and, like, the response is kind of like, we'll have to think about this one. So, yeah, it was just kind of like thrown in there, and then like it didn't do poorly, but it just kind of like got like a like shrug response, like, we have to think about this, we don't really know how to respond to this film. And then like whatever big film premiere is like, oh, this film is da 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 da. So yeah,
this is Bleecker Street. And I checked out the reactions from South By, and I saw way more negative responses than I assumed. You know, I thought people were just kind of mixed on the film, and there were some mixed things. There were some 3 out of 5 stars, you know. There were a lot of 2 out of 5 stars, 1 out of 5 stars, reviews on along those lines. But this is an interesting film. It's a film about masculinity, for sure. Definitely toxic masculinity, but also passive masculinity. It's definitely a film about what it's like to be a man in the modern day. And I can see why that would be really tough for some people to get behind, in a sense, because there are a lot of films covering this material. I'd say the easiest way to describe it is it's like a cross between Fight Club and The Karate Kid. And in the sense that, like, the first half is is Karate Kid, the second half is Fight Club. And I think, from what I can gather, this feels like two different movies. In the halfway point, this film takes a bit of a turn. And I think your mileage for it varies on what you think of that turn. And I was a little mixed on where this film goes, because I kind of didn't want it to go in the direction that it did. I was having a good time with it in the first half, and it goes in a direction that is a little tough. So this film, like I said, stars Jesse Eisenberg. He is this very, very passive, very effeminate 35-year-old guy who never stands up for himself, who is a bit awkward, and he's definitely on the spectrum. And he just, it's one of those things where he's on the spectrum and he doesn't really know what to do about it. He's kind of on his own. He doesn't know how to relate with people. And one day, he gets beaten up pretty viciously, and he decides that he needs to start learning self-defense. And getting a gun is too complicated, so he decides to start enrolling in karate lessons. And quite quickly, karate seems to like fill this gap for him that nothing ever has before, where he starts to feel like more powerful. He starts to feel a bit more like he can fit into this society. And a lot of people have referred to this film as sort of like a film about incels. Those are like involuntary celibates. And that's kind of true a little bit. I think it's more about the incel culture than it is literally like somebody who just can't connect with women, because this isn't a film where he's like wishing he could be in a relationship. Like, that's not an element here. The element is he wants to be like the men who intimidate him. He wants to fit into this tone of masculinity that he doesn't understand. And one of the reasons I connected with this character is like I said, he is on the spectrum, and a lot of films like this can sort of turn being on the spectrum into a superpower, which is very weird, I think, whenever this sort of happens. What this film does...
Definitely familiar with that.
For sure. What this film does is it sort of narrows in on what is actually advantageous about being on the spectrum, and it's that you're able to be a little obsessive in the sense that you can put a lot of your energy and focus into one thing and get very good at it very quickly. And it's like this, you can have an allegiance to something that allows you to progress quickly and to master something in a way that so other people might not be able to. And that really clicked and registered with me. I've seen that be something that actually like plays out. Like you don't become the best at it, but you do sort of take on something, and it's all or nothing. It's either all this or nothing this. And this is a film about a person who learns about what toxic masculinity is and goes through this process of like figuring out what's right, what's wrong, in a very, what you find out is a very misogynistic dojo, like extremely so. And there was a point in this movie where you get to this point where stuff sort of hits the fan, and I was really into it. I was really into what Stearns was saying and like what his point was. And it's complicated though. I could easily see somebody watch this movie and really have a negative taste in their mouth about it, or bitter taste, because it goes there. It goes to some places that I don't think are very agreeable. But I think that's why I'm liking it. I think that's why, and I think the ending isn't elegant. It's messy. This is a very messy film. But I think it swings really hard, and it I don't know, it's tackling subject material that I think other filmmakers are a little scared to tackle in a more authentic way, where they want to like portray toxic masculinity as something like an evil villain to be defeated, rather than something that's in every man for the most part. And that's a reason why I kind of got on board. And I think it's a very specifically for me kind of movie. I really enjoy that they don't glamorize the martial arts here. Like, this isn't a film that makes it be like, oh, cool. Like, I didn't want to go get karate lessons after this movie the way that you do when you watch like Karate Kid or Cobra Kai, right? It doesn't glamorize in the way that Fight Club does, where you're like, oh, me and my friends got to get a Fight Club. This movie ends and you're just like, I'm glad I didn't go through that.
I don't know if we had the same interpretations for Fight Club or Cobra Kai, but
well,
okay.
Well, we didn't, but I know people who did watch Fight Club, and I think that really ties into the incel culture, where like they look at that movie as sort of like their Bible. And I know I have plenty of friends who consider Fight Club aspirational. And
sure.
Me personally, I don't know if you can really get that from Art of Self-Defense because of the way certain things are framed, but I want to just really shout out Jesse Eisenberg, Alessandro Nivola, and Imogen Poots, who are just, they're the three main actors here, and they are just,
I like them all.
There is like a literalness to this movie. Like, the dialogue is a little off. Everyone speaks a little bit like a Wes Anderson character in a way, and it's its own thing for sure, but that's definitely what you'll think of. But especially between Eisenberg and Nivola, it's like, I don't know if I've ever seen two characters relate with each other in this way, and there's something very deeply, there's something homoerotic about it. I mean, homoeroticism is all over this movie, and which is to be expected in a film about masculinity, but just watching these two characters interact and watching how Nivola sort of looks at this guy and figures out his weak points, figures out how to like ingratiate him into this dojo. It's definitely distressing, but also weirdly entertaining. I was laughing a lot during this movie, but in a very like ironic way, or not ironic. I was laughing not at this movie, but I was laughing with just how offbeat it is. It's so offbeat, this movie. And in a way that I think, well, I think you should check it out. I can't guarantee that you'll like it. Sure. I can't guarantee that you'll like it as much as I did, but I think you will appreciate what it's going for. And I hope it registers with you in the way that it has with me. Although I do have complicated feelings about it, I have a feeling you'll agree with me that the ending could be a little bit better in terms of where they go with it. But I think the journey there is really worth people's time. And especially in a film culture at the moment that I get the sense a lot these days that films just aren't really trying to be responsive to the times and to like how people really are. And like, I just think films are just trying to like, I don't think they're really connecting with where the culture's at, with what people, I think this is especially true with pop music. It's just all like, let's go party, let's go hang out, you know.
We're young.
Yeah. And these are really tough times for a lot of people. People can't make money. People aren't able to follow their dreams. Like we live in a very counter, a culture that's wanting to be more countercultural, but our art isn't, for the most part, isn't really measuring up to that. It's all just sort of like, mm-hmm. come see the new Lion King. It's just like the old Lion King.
Right.
And listen to this song about breakups.
I mean, I think there is something, though. I mean, this is a whole discussion, so I won't try to elaborate on it too much. But I do think there is something to the idea of, like, see Aladdin, see Lion King. Like, these are movies from your past. Revisit the memories when things were safer and easier before, like, you know, like, everything went to the crap. Like, I do think there is something to that mentality as far as art is concerned. But I do agree that there is, I think, more than anything else, like, kind of a commercial cynicism to that that is definitely not reflective of our times.
Right. This is the sort of film that I think should be coming out in 2019. It reminds me of 1969, that year of film, which is a fascinating year because that was the year, well, even like the second half of the 60s, very tumultuous time. And it was at this point where Hollywood just didn't know what to do. Like they didn't know, like box office was floundering in the late 60s because people were like, we don't want musicals. We don't want these old fashioned Westerns. I think that's what Once Upon a Time in Hollywood's probably going to be about. It's like, we want Bonnie and Clyde. We want The Graduate. We want Easy Rider. Like, we want these films that are challenging, that are actually like about how frustrated we are with Vietnam and all of these things. And that's the sort of thing I've been kind of like looking out for in 2019. And Art of Self-Defense, I can't say it's up to those standards, but it's at least trying to be about where we are right now, even though it has like this sort of throwback aesthetic where there are no like cell phones and like people use VHS tapes and stuff like that. But I think it's nice. I think it adds like a kind of a layer to how tangible this world is, where there's no like connectivity. Everything is like face to face. And I really dug that about this film, and I really dug so much of what this film is doing. So I can't say it's a treatise on the culture, but it's at least an example of something that's just, I don't know, punching above its weight, not to be as punny as it gets. So yeah, that's The Art of Self-Defense. I give this a B. I don't think it's as accessible as it should be. It's like, I kind of alluded to this earlier, but it's like the opposite of The Farewell, where like The Farewell works because it's so specific. It's so specific that it's universal, but The Art of Self-Defense is the same thing. It's very specific. It's tackling a very specific type of white man who is like, who's so specific to this being on the spectrum, this like mode of his life, but it doesn't have that same universal appeal. And I think it speaks to like sort of the wonder and nebulity or whatever that word is for movies, because you can have a movie like The Farewell, which does that same sort of thing, and it just really, really works, where you can just readily recommend it to everyone. But then you have Art of Self-Defense, which is doing, it's also very specific, but I don't think it's going to appeal to everyone. And it's just kind of funny how all that works. It's very mysterious, but I definitely like the film on those terms enough to say it's a B movie for me, close to a B plus, but not quite. So yeah, that's Art of Self-Defense. And hopefully we can talk more about this when you get a chance to see it, Will. I think we could probably have some interesting spoiler discussions, because this movie goes into some crazy directions.
For sure. Yeah. I am very enticed by the film after the way you described it, although I have no idea when this is going to come to my city, if it is going to come to my city at all. I don't really know. But yeah, if it does come, I'll check it out. Thanks for the recommendation.
Hey, definitely manage your expectations. I think I'm in the minority. Although, you know, on Rotten Tomatoes, the film has a 95% off of 20 reviews. So it's not necessarily, you know, it's not like it's getting panned. I think people are giving it a pass. Sure. At least so far critically. But yeah, I'm definitely one of the few critics out there, I guess, who is actually saying like it's for specific people who are interested in the material, they should check it out. And like it or hate it, I think you'll enjoy the experience. But that is Art of Self-Defense, and that is our last film. Next week, we're going to be talking about The Lion King, which my review for that is already live on theyoungfolks.com. Definitely go check that out. But that's hitting a huge wide release of 4,500 theaters, to the point where no other wide releases are coming out. There's one limited release, David Crosby, Remember My Name, which that's going to be hitting limited release. But Will, Lion King, are you going to be able to see this one before the weekend?
So far as I know, I don't have a screening for it, so I don't know. I mean, unless they surprise us, which is entirely possible, I don't think that's going to happen.
I'm a little worried because I don't know if we could talk about Lion King for an entire episode, so maybe we might have to do something a little bit creative to round that out.
Normally with these live-action remakes, I usually watch the anime film before, but I feel like it might be better for me to watch the original Lion King again after I see this, or what would you think?
Definitely after. Yeah, because you'll just be frustrated because you feel like you just watched that movie.
And okay, that's what I thought.
So. The nice thing about watching it after is that you can actually like appreciate the good movie. Just saying, Lion King is, in my opinion, not a good movie, but we will talk about it. Yeah.
Oh, you mean the new one?
The new one, Yeah. Oh, yeah, okay. The original is a classic, so.
Right, that's what I thought. Yeah, I was like, is this a hot take from John Negroni at the end of this episode?
Lion King is overrated. Circle of life, my ass. But yeah, that's Lion King. We'll talk about it this weekend. Until then, don't forget to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and check out our Patreon if you're interested. Thanks as always for listening. And if you are hungry for more CinemaHawks content, check out our bonus episode on Midsummer. All our stuff is on cinemahawks.com. Go hang out with us. We'll see you next week from the Internet California. I am John Negroni.
And from the Internet Pennsylvania, I'm Wash.
See you next time.